Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com to get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAG10 for 10% off your first purchase.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello and welcome to Series 3 of Humans of Excess Manchester with me, Clint Boone. This series is sponsored by our friends over at Safer Roads GM, helping us to keep ourselves and each other safe on the roads of Manchester. This week I'm joined by legendary bassist and member of the Stone Roses, Gary Mountfield, aka Manny. Manny talks about discovering more about his family's Irish heritage from none other than Primal Scream frontman Bobby Gillespie.
And he went, it's right. And I said, what? He said, your family brought Johnny Marr's mum up.
And he describes what it was like when the Stone Roses took off.
My dream from school was being a band, make a record, go on Top of the Pops. And we did that pretty quick. You know, and then it's like, well, you've got to set yourself some new targets, boy, yeah. You know.
It gives me great pleasure to welcome to Humans of Excess Manchester a chap who's not only one of the most highly regarded British musicians of all time, he's also one of the most loved Mancunians ever. It's my old mate, Gary Mountfield, a.k.a. Manny, a.k.a. The Nod. How are you?
I'm all right, Clint. Yeah.
Good to see you, brother. You're looking well.
Well, do you know what? I've neglected to have a shave, the scruffy sod that I am.
We're going to be talking, obviously, about your amazing career. We're going to be talking about your life in general. We're going to talk about Manchester, which is the main reason we do these podcasts. First, I want to talk about you, the little baby Gary. Where were you born and when, Manny?
Manchester, November 1962.
Was it Crumpsall Hospital?
No, well, do you know what? I always was led to believe it was, and it wasn't. It was the MRI.
Oh, was it?
As it turns out, yeah. So I'm not as North Manc as I would have you believe.
Right. And is it true you're a poorly baby? Well, you told me you were a poorly baby.
I think I was born almost 3 months primo.
Right.
So I weighed £2 summit. So, Joe, back in the day there, you were just put on the back step, and if you were still kicking in the morning, you're all right. You've got a chance, haven't you? You know what I mean? Here I am.
That's the story of your life, isn't it? Still, still find yourself up back step quite often, don't you, man?
Very often, my friend.
We'll mention the story in a bit about the time that me and my wife, Charlie, thought you died on our couch. We'll touch on that later. Back to your childhood, though. Your mum was from a very strong Irish background, wasn't she?
Yeah, do you know where it... Well, I don't know whether you had Johnny in the other week. I don't know whether he touched on the plaque thing that... I'd just been in the village of Athy in County Kildare, which is obviously probably the county town of where they're from. And they both lived, there's a strip of seven houses. My family lived two from the end of one end, and Johnny's mum lived at the other end. And there's nothing there. There's an old church, a school about as big as a garden shed. Six or seven houses and loads of fields and stuff. And it's weird how me and him have come from that lineage, ended up doing what we're doing in the same city and in the same profession and stuff.
Have you always known about that connection between your ancestors and Johnny Mars?
No, Johnny's uncles, Lukey and Birdie and their family were always talked about off my family, but how I come to find out was Gillespie from The Scream, Bob, just got us on one side one day and said, what's your mum's maiden name? So I said, well, it's a bit of a weird one, but Farrell, you know. And he went, it's right. And I said, what? He said, your family brought Johnny Mars' mum up. And then I did a bit of investigation with my auntie Ellen Farrell. And she said, oh, yeah, the Mars and her family were the Dorans and the Doyles. And so,
and they put a plaque on the local, is it a local pub they put the plaque on?
They've done, there's a place in Athy where everybody's parents from there who were leaving Ireland, which they all had to do to go to the mainland England to get work or even beyond. That's where the bus went from outside this bar, and it's called the Emigrants Bar.
Oh, really?
And it's in this little town square in Athy. So it's quite apt. A guy, Colm, has put this thing together as a bit of a tourist thing for the area. And it turns out, like, Johnny Cash's granddad was from round there and blah-de-blah and all these other people and me and Johnny. So my mum would have loved it, and it's come full circle. And I took my kids there, and I took my kids to the graveyard where all the fellows are buried, and, you know, all the Mars are buried there, and the Doyles and all our respective families, and just give them a bead on their Irishness. You know, they have got that in the bloodstream. So it was nice for them to see kind of where it's from. And you look at the size of an house, and it was like eight kids living in it and stuff.
Yeah.
Insane, isn't it?
What about your dad's background? He wasn't Irish, was he?
No, my dad was from Stockport, High Lane, Disley.
Posh.
Well, no, not the posh. Nobody in my family's ever been posh, Clint. You met half of them. But he was... my granddad and his dad, George, worked on the railway. You know, when I can remember as a kid being tucked to just where B&Q is in Stockport now, there was like a goods yard there, and my granddad's job was to operate the turntable that turned the steam trains and that round.
Wow.
And I think his dad before him was in LNW, London North West Rail Line. So he worked for that. My dad was a chef.
I remember. Well, he was a celebrated chef as well.
It was good. It was trained off what you would probably call a Michelin-starred guy. He ended up working at the Bernie Inns in Oldham, didn't he? Bless him, but all that talent, and he was just happy doing that, you know?
But people used to talk about him, because this is in the days before, we're talking like the early 80s here, as I remember it, and people talked about him as a local celebrity chef. He was that good at doing what he did.
Oh, don't get me wrong, he was an excellent cook and an excellent fella, you know? It's not like myself, pretty friendly, you know, dead easy going and approachable and stuff. Yeah, very down-to-earth bloke.
Yeah.
And my brother followed him into that cooking.
Little Greg.
Yep. and I ran away to join a circus, as you know. And you helped me for that, didn't you?
Yeah, I've got played a little part in that. So an happy childhood then, generally?
Yeah, it was an happy childhood. You know, we weren't blessed with riches but it was a lot of love in the house, a lot of encouragement. You know, like I was always encouraged to follow me dream. Like most of the time, I know your family are pretty bohemian in that way, and it would always give you enough rope to hang yourself or tie the world up with, you know what I mean? Yeah. So I was always indulged slightly, but not overindulged, you know what I mean? I never spoke with it, but they always said, you know, if you choose your path, just go with it, which I think's pretty good. You can be a bit too controlling, can't you, with folk?
Definitely.
And you know me, I was never to be controlled.
Loose cannon.
I'm very loose, mate, yeah.
What about music? Was there a lot of music in the house when you were growing up?
But not the kind of music like you'd expect, like your Elvis or Beatles or something. There was a lot of Irish music, a lot of folk, in a way. Nat King Cole, Sinatra, Johnny Mathis. My dad was a Woody Guthrie and Dylan kind of guy, and... I think my dad liked jazz. He's a guy called Maynard Ferguson who he had records of. I think he's a jazz trumpeter.
Right.
And then the stylistics and stuff like that. You know what I mean?
I used to love them.
So like a bit of like Philly soul kind of thing. Yeah. But yeah, there was always music about, but it wasn't kind of like the be all and end all. It wasn't, nothing revolved around it in our house. It was left to me to basically grow up through the glam period of the early 70s is when I started getting into Slade and, you know, a bit of maybe T-Rex, Bowie for sure.
What about school? How did you get on at school? Did you thrive or were you a bit of a...
I think when I was at junior school, I went to St Dunstan's in Moston. I think I did shine on there. I stood out because I was always a pretty studious kid for reading, and it's like one of my kids, Gene, now is an absolute knowledge box, you know what I mean? He's got very retentive memory and stuff. So I was always for feeding my head, you know, feeding my head with other stuff in later life, but I was always for knowledge, you know, and wanting to know about things. I think he always wanted more than he had, or I wanted to look beyond the parameters that were set for me by my social leanings and where you were brought up. But I think I did well at St Dunstan's, and there was some legend that I got the second highest score in the 11-plus in my year at school. I don't know, someone's mum was on the JMB or something, and I think it might be a load of crap, to be fair. But, yeah, I'll take it.
Yeah.
Because I always had a pretty computer-esque memory for recall and stuff like that. And then when I went to secondary school, got myself a place at Severian College when it was an all-boys school, and... was kind of taught off geezers in dresses, a lot of monks and stuff, which is a bit of a weird one.
Same here, we were at De La Salle Brothers.
So the Severian Builders, and our Greg ended up got Cardinal Langley, which had Builders there, and I suppose it's a weird one, that, because they pretty much drummed religion out of me. Sharpish.
I hear it. That's exactly what happened to me. I've been saying that for years, and I hear it a lot, and I've heard it on this podcast where people of our generation got... Like I said, they got the religion punished out of them.
I don't want to cause offence to no one, because everyone's free to do what they want to do, as Bobby Gillespie said in some bloody tune or another. But it certainly made me question everything.
Yeah.
And then by about the third year, along came The Clash and the Slaughter of the Dogs and punk.
Yeah.
So much the same as yourself. And that really opened me up and changed me into... A, what I loved, and B, what I foresaw I really wanted to do later in life. I didn't want to do anything but be in a band from then onwards, you know?
Yeah.
I think my grades started suffering, started wagging it a bit, you know, like you do. Somehow I managed to beg, borrow and steal my first guitar out of a catalogue or something, and then started from that. That's where that started.
I've never thought of this before, but just sort of came to them when you're saying it about... Do you reckon that kids that went through that period of education that we went through, in my case, the early 70s, you were 3 or 4 years later than me, but we went through that horrible period of getting the punishment at school, and then not a happy time, then suddenly, bang, this punk thing happens. And it was almost like that was sent from heaven for us, wasn't it? If we'd have grown up in an happier school environment and with gentle folk looking after us...
We'd have been into B.A. Robertson or some rubbish, you know
so
what I mean?
Almost, it's almost like the two are intrinsically linked, isn't it? That gruesome period of education followed by this heavenly music movement.
Well, that kind of forced you into a rebellion stance, didn't it, in a way? You know what I mean? And I think the punk thing coming along was just... Like you said, it was heaven sent. That it was just at the right time. It spoke to us about what we were feeling and what were going on, you know, socially and what have you in the world. And it gave me politics as well. You know what I mean? It made me sort of start questioning and thinking about socioeconomic stuff and all that. You know what I mean? Which is cool.
With bands like The Clash.
You look at kids these days, mate, and they don't have politics. They don't have nothing, do they? It's sterile for a minute. We had causes and we had stuff to believe in. Mm. Like you said, with The Clash and all that, I would never know anything about the Sandinistas and stuff going on in Central America and stuff like that, and, you know, the plight of black people in Brixton and stuff like that. So it was like a political radio station, wasn't it? You know, listening to those tunes.
It was an awakening, wasn't it, for us? Yep. What about, you got into scootering, didn't you, soon after that? You became a bit of a scooter boy. Before I'd met you, I didn't know you at this point.
Yeah, well, probably from about 79, so 78, late 78, early 79, and I think I was just coming out of the punk thing, probably getting just into being a bit of a petty boy or something like that, or a bit of a half Penny Boy, half Mod or something. And I got my first Lambretta off my stepdad's uncle Ian Barlow from Middleton. And that started me off on that. And then from there, I began to explore like Tamla Motown music and like older brothers, like my mate Lee Butterworth. His older brother used to go to Wigan and we were listening to his Sevens and all that from the casino and learning about the Motown and Stax thing. And then from that, you know, the more the moddy thing crept in, you were going to all-nighters on scooter runs and then you were discovering stuff like Hendrix and Freak Beat and Garage, you know, the Nuggets and Pebbles and all that kind of stuff. Mm. All the while, you're assimilating these bits of knowledge into your own canon, aren't you?
Yeah, totally. Yeah.
And that's, I can't really know what music. You probably can because you're better than I am at it. But,
give over.
But I think you can learn so much from other people from just ingesting so many different styles of stuff. Mm. Like, I remember the gigs we used to go to, go and watch bloody all sorts of people, didn't we?
Yeah.
Mad amounts of gigs, always going gigs.
Yeah.
And there's your knowledge. That's right there. You know, I think kids need to pick up their ears a bit more these days and get with that concept somewhat.
Absolutely. So this is you were living in Failsworth. Early 80s, I think when I first met you, 1983, Miners Arms, Oldham.
Yeah.
The pub's still there. There's no plaque on it yet. but my mate, Chris Goodwin, who was our mutual friend, even though I'd never met you, Chris was playing drums in a band called Wheatstone's Bridge.
Yeah, with Malik.
Malik Green on guitar.
And he was the big bass man who used to do cartoons about with his big Selma amp. Remember them cartoons?
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, I've still got them all at home. Was it called, the big lad?
I know, yeah.
Well, there was Howard. Howard was bass, wasn't he? Then Kev McGladrey took over and yeah. Batch on drums.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
But anyway, so Chris, one night, Saturday night, 83, says, this is my mate, man. He told me about you.
Yeah.
Got his mates into all the psychedelic music. Bit of a mod. Little fella. Spends a lot of time on back doorstep. He says... He's coming up to his gig because I used to go see Chris every Saturday night and I remember him introducing. I remember where we stood, all three of us stood there chatting. And I think if I'm not, because we'd said then let's do some jamming together, start a band. Yeah. And I think it was either the following day or the following Sunday, we all got together in the mill in Ashton and we started then every weekend for like a year and a bit, just recording these mad sessions.
Oh, it was crazy, wasn't it?
Great time.
Anything goes, you know, like metal smashing, bottles going in metal bins. There was like, we didn't need to make hospital beds or something there.
Well, it was a furniture company. I'd ended up accidentally becoming a company director. I was like 21, 22 or something.
Right.
But it meant I had a bit of control over what to do with some of the space in the building. But we originally started jamming just on the shop floor, didn't we, next to the welding set. And
yeah,
the
Guy Bridge, so, wasn't Guy it, Bridge, as it was called, wasn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, the Guy Bridge Mill. But yeah, like you said, some of it was psychedelic, some of it was like industrial Einstein's End and Neubau, wasn't it? Fire extinguishers going off and that. But then we had this one bit where we got a microphone, set it in to record, put the mic on the floor and then drove the forklift truck over it. So you can hear the recording going, you hear the forklift truck coming on.
Yeah, well, I was experimental before our time in a lot of ways with that, wasn't it?
But you at that point, you'd already known Ian Brown.
He'd been in the patrol John and Andy Cousins before.
Yeah.
And then him and Andy had nicked off. They actually come up, didn't they, one Sunday?
They came to jam with. We were thinking of getting together, making a big band out, because the mill was a three-piece band. Yeah. And you said Ian and Andy are going to come up. They fancy forming a bigger band. And they came in. I remember they pulled up in a big American car that Andy had.
55 Chevrolet.
That's the one, And they came walking in and we were just doing our thing with forklift trucks and broken glass. Andy played Rockabilly guitar. I've still got the recording of it.
Oh, brilliant.
And then they went.
Yeah, never to be seen again.
Yeah, but happy days. And then that sort of went on through 85 and then I think late 85, early 86, you got a day job. You went working at the Palace, didn't you, doing lights?
Yeah, I worked at the Opera House and the Palace Theatres for a bit. No pay, no play, innit? So Maggie Thatcher's Britain wasn't good for lining your pockets with dough for good times. But I loved my job at the Palace and the Opera House, really did love it. And I used to bits at the Devonport and Stockport and there was one in Gatley as well. But yeah, made good friends there. Worked on lots of the big shows that used to come out of... the West End of London.
Yeah.
It was good. And the hours were good because you only had to do like a matinee Wednesday afternoon and then it was all starting from about 6:30 at night till 10. So that was good. And then used to end up in that bloody Hardman Street club round the corner till stupid o'clock. Because there was no getting up to be done, was there?
So as a musician then, you were pretty much off the mat, weren't you? Chris went off and started a band called The High that made some beautiful records. Yeah. I went off and joined a bunch of Herberts from Oldham calling ourselves In Spiral Carpets.
Yeah.
You were pretty much off the map for a while as a musician.
Yeah.
As I remember it. And there was that thing in 87 where I was in the Boardwalk one night, I think with Graham out the In Spirals. And it was a quiet night. I can't remember who the band was that were playing. But I remember Ian Brown and John Squire were sat at a table. And it was when they had a table and chairs at the Boardwalk. I went over chatting to them and said, how's it going? And Ian said, oh, it's not so good, actually. Just our bass player's left.
Right.
Pete.
Yeah.
We're after a new bass player. Do you know any? And I said, well, our bass player at the time, Scott Curry, he'd love that gig.
Yeah.
Because the Roses were established a bit on the scene locally. They weren't.
Yeah.
None of us knew how big they were going to get. We said, you can't have Scott because we need him, but I'll keep my ears open. And the next day, I bumped into your kid in Manchester, your Greg, Oldham Street.
He's a legend, isn't it?
I said, tell your kid, sack that job off, get his bass back on. The Roses need a bass player.
Yeah, yeah. And that was it, wasn't it? Cheers, Glenn. See, now he's going to hit me for money now, isn't he? Nice, check him out.
Nice, right. But have you got any? So, yeah, from that, it was pretty whirlwind then, wasn't it? I mean, because within weeks, I remember one of your first things was going recording with Peter Hook, Sweet 16, Rochdale's studio. He was going to produce your his Elephant Storm.
Yeah, we demoed a few things up there with him. And then we ended up recording in Revolution in Cheadle with, I think it was Mike who used to like engineer or something for New Order, and Hooker, who did Elephant Stone. Probably did some bees up at Sweet 16. And then it was just one of them, give the job up, used to take two or three buses a day over to International 2 in Rehearsal, and this back bar down there every day.
Mm.
And there was a place, the Spirit Lockup in Chorlton, which is now a carpet warehouse or something, but we used to do that until King of the Slums used to come in and start making such a racket next door that we had to down tools and shoot off.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Those early days of the Roses, it was mind-blowing for us to see, as not just as friends, but as outsiders from that band. It was unique what they did, the whole approach, like doing the warehouse parties that nobody had ever done. That was all brand new. Refusing to do encores. Ian walking off while still singing onto the dance floor and facing up to guys twice his size.
Oh, I always used to do that, didn't I?
It was like, I'd never seen a band at that time do anything like that.
I suppose, you used to go watching them because they were mates and all that before I was in them. And I always knew there was something a bit special with him, you know. And one day, quality wills out, don't it? You know what I mean? And I knew they'd get there somewhere down the line. But to find myself in it was even better, you know.
Yeah.
Because it's like my dream from school was being a band, make a record, go on Top of the Pops. And we did that pretty quick. You know, and then it's like, well, you've got to set yourself some new targets, boy, you know.
Didn't make any money out of it, though, did you?
Do you know what? It's a lot put on money. It's not all about the money. If we'd have earned the dough that we have sort of now, then I don't think probably one or two of us would still be here, you know.
What were your best memories of those early days?
Just getting in vans. It was an absolute novel, you know. There's four members of the band and all the entourage and the crew, who were all mates, and it was like a rolling comedy club. It was funny. But don't take nothing away from the fact that we weren't absolutely dedicated to our craft, because we were.
Yeah.
And anyone who knows us, you know, and people would turn around and say, oh, you've been lucky. Don't enter into it. You have to create your own.
And what you created was just, it was unique and beautiful, and it inspired the next generation of musicians, didn't it? Not just from Manchester.
I'd like to think so, but I'd never, like, stick my hat out and go, yeah, anybody owes us out, because no one did. If you can... It's like the same way The Clash gave us the seeds of thought to go out, pick it up and do it yourself.
Mm.
That's the way we looked at it, was like, music isn't a closed shop. If you can give some kid on an estate in Chester or Liverpool or Glasgow or whatever the same beans to get an instrument and go do it for themselves, then you've won, you know.
Yeah.
That's what it's all about, isn't it?
That's what you did.
Yeah.
Chapter 1 ended in 96, Reading Festival. And then immediately after, I remember I spoke to you the day that the news came out, soon after Reading, the announcement came out that you were sacking it off, and splitting up. And I spoke to you on the phone that day. I don't even remember this call, but you said, your actual words were something like, shit's hit the fan. I'm off to London, got to speak to lawyers and managers and that, and then I'm going to come back up north and we'll get the mill back together. So I'm thinking, like, yes, right, okay. Get the old keyboards out ready and all that. Anyway, you only went and bumped into Bobby Gillespie then, didn't you?
Well, I actually bumped into him on the Last Roses tour in Brighton. And him and his girlfriend at the time, Emily Hughes, were walking back to the flat with bags of bloody shopping from whichever store they'd been to. And we kidnapped him and got him right on the lash. And then we kidnapped him on our tour bus. And he came and he ended up and said, Bobby said he woke up in Newport with me getting screamed at off my then partner, the mother of Joe, my oldest kid, because I'd not been asked to phone it up or something. I don't know. Just been having too good of a time again. But I think sometime during that journey, maybe it was mooted that if this came apart, how would they feel about me going that way? And so the deal was kind of mooted. And then when it all did fall apart, straight away, Alex Nightingale's on the phone and I'm down and I'm in there. But I did phone Ian to ask for his blessing, which I thought was
honourable.
An honourable and decent thing to do for a man who had been through the trenches with and had the good and then had the bad.
Mm.
So, and Ian just totally gave me his blessing and then it was all good, you know.
Yeah, beautiful. And what a great band to... I can't think of a more suitable band for you to have popped into, coming out of the Roses then and into Primal Scream, because you had a bunch of kindred spirits there, didn't you, in that band?
Oh, my God. They made me look like Alan Jones in comparison, you know.
I was going to say, is it true, the extent of the debauchery?
Oh,
in
my
the,
God. It's, you know, it, savage. Savagery. And now not more than one of them is dead, is beyond me. But then again, some people are made from bloody Kevlar, aren't they, when it comes to it?
Did you tour the States? Were you playing with the Stones or something, with the Primals or not? Well, it was a big band you'd support.
Yeah, we did 5 gigs with the Stones. We did 4 in Europe and Twickenham. It was nice. They would come and watch us because we kind of in London, you bump into the set of people and you knew Jay Jagger and you knew Marlon Richards and... You know, Marlon invited me and Bobby into Keith's personal dressing room called the Shebeen, and we walked in and it's done up like a bloody Moroccan tent. There's a full-size snooker table in there, a bar, and a jukebox blaring Chuck Berry out, and he stood there with his Telecaster.
This is backstage?
Backstage at a Stones gig, and me and Bobby are like pinching each other, like, check it out. And he comes over, he's like, hey, Marlon says you cats rock, man, you know? And it was like, yeah, this Keith Richards knows who we are.
Brilliant.
And then you turn around on stage and Charlie's watching you. And then he comes up to me and Daz later and says, you're in a great rhythm section. It's just like, mate, you know what I mean?
Amazing.
This is different gravy, this.
Happy days.
Yeah, yeah.
It was a good day, great chapter of your life, that one.
Yeah. Do you know what? Here's how tight the Rolling Stones are.
Go on.
they made us buy tickets for our birds.
Oh, did they?
Right, oh, sorry, so you can't say birds, can you? I think you can. Our betters, should I say. But to get round it, we give them jobs as wardrobe mistresses to get them in. But I think Mick still stood there clicking them in and making sure they paid. That's how he's rich, isn't it? That's how rich stay rich, because they tight arses.
Let's talk about Freebase. 2005, somebody came up with this amazing concept of getting 3 of the best bass players ever, all Manchester lads, Andy Roach, Smiths, Peter Hook, New Order, Joy Division, yourself, Stone Roses, Primals, and you became Free Bass, which is a play on the word three bass.
Well,
worth it just for that, wasn't it?
Oh, do you know, that was good for the Glen, but that come about was the fact that I think I was in between albums with a Scream. Hookie was always complaining that Bernard had never do enough graft, and it, you know what he's like. You see what he's doing now, Peter, with the light. He's a workaholic.
Yeah.
So we just decided to start getting our heads together at this Mad Rogers Mad place up in the hills, and just chucking some ideas down on tape. And then I'm out then again with the Scream, and Hookie and Phil are in there chopping things up. And next thing you know, they formulated these ideas into songs, and it was like, well, let's go and try and attempt to play him. And we ended up doing 6 gigs with him and pressed an LP up, and then it all fell apart rather quickly.
Like you said, the name was The Grin, wasn't it? That was the big thing, the Freebase idea. But
yeah.
And then you had a bit of a fallout with Lucky, didn't you? In, was it 2010 when you had a go at him on
Twitter. That was me. Pissed up one night.
Was it the vodka talking?
It was the vodka talking, and I most humbly apologise.
No, you're busy mates again,
right? Kissed the maid up, but yeah, I was a bit out of order. But you know what I'm like? If someone sticks a twig into the hornet's nest, someone's getting stung, aren't they?
Yeah. Do you remember that time when we thought you'd died on our couch in Stockport?
Well, I just remember being very drunk.
But Charlie's actual words, my wife was there.
I thought he was dying.
I think he's fucking dead.
Well, listen, that's being in Primal Scream will do that to you. You know what I mean?
But thankfully, you're still here, and you and Hucky are good mates again.
Yeah.
And you got into the club DJing thing as well, as I did myself and Hucky did subsequently. Great way of meeting your fans, wasn't it?
I'm a firm believer in trying to give something back. You know, in a weird way, if people want to come up and have the photo took with you, then and come up and get something signed, I think people who consistently push people away in that position want a kick in the nads, basically.
Because they've forgotten.
Because these are the people that put you where you are.
Absolutely, absolutely.
But alternatively, I think I was getting chinned in some club off Imelda one night, and someone come up for an autograph and went, do you mind if I just finish getting battered first? Probably deserved it, love, as well, if you're listening.
She will be listening. Have you hung up your DJ headphones? Are you still doing it?
I can't be arsed with it all anymore, Clint. You know what? Do you know, for me, going out and doing that, it's great, like you say, meeting the fans, but when you just stood there, all I do is start walloping drinks down my neck and... much as I used to enjoy it, I've wound my neck right in now a bit on that. Yeah. You know what I mean?
Settle down a bit.
Yeah. 50 bloody six, mate.
You're looking good for it.
Thank you.
You're still breathing. That's the main thing, isn't it? Still breathing.
Just.
Let's talk about a moment in 2011 when it became quite public. Well, before it became public, the moment that you realised that the band was getting back together, 2011, the Roses were getting back together, how did you feel? Were you the happiest man in the world?
It's weird because my mum, God bless her, Upton, died, didn't she? And just right at the end of rehearsals for the Scream tour, and in between the dying and the funeral, I had to go out doing gigs and all that. And then I think we played Manchester on the Sunday and the funeral was on the Monday. So there was a day off and then down to Brighton. So, you know, the funeral works out well on my day off, you know what I mean? And so I was expecting the Scream lot to just get the bus and go straight down to Brighton, you know what I mean, and lead me to it. And then I was going to take the train down and join them next day. But as I'm driving up in the bloody big black limo behind the coffin and all that, I look and there's Bobby and all the lads, which is a nice show of solidarity.
Yeah.
And then Bobby's just sort of like, looked over and there's John and Ian stood together. It's the first time I'd seen them in each other's company in maybe 16 years, 15 years.
Yeah.
So that was absolutely heartwarming to see that. And I thought, well, if nothing else, if they've rekindled the friendship, then it's good. I think my old dink dying has served a good purpose to mend a childhood friendship in a way.
Yeah.
But then when it went to something else and then there's talk of the band reforming was great because it was always like unfinished business for me anyway. And I'm kind of glad we've done it, you know, because we just ended up playing to the potential which we had back in the day, but which was denied us by an unfortunate chain of events, shall we say.
Yeah.
And many different facets to it, none of which I'm going to go into.
You don't need to.
Yeah.
But the reception that the, not just the news of you getting back together, the reception you got when you went out there was just phenomenal. It must have been breathtaking. I remember a moment in my life where the Inspirals were split in 95, got back together in 2003. First gig after 9 year break was at Sheffield Uni, I think. And we're about to go on stage. We're behind the backdrop. The intro tape was playing. And the feeling that I got, it was just one of the most amazing feelings I've ever had in my life, knowing that we're about to walk on stage. You must have had that times 1,000 when you walked back out on the Power Hall, Warrington.
Well, yeah, it was a euphoric release, massively.
Yeah.
We knew what we'd done. First time round, we knew the effect we had on people. We knew the loyalty of the fans, and it was staggering to see just the enormity of how much bigger it just seemed second time around.
Yeah. Let's talk about your own life. Now, you've settled down a lot, as we've said. You've got two little boys. Are they six and a bit now?
Yeah, they were six in December, and I love them. And it's made me sort of you've got to reevaluate your stuff, and it's made me wound my neck in, because you know what I'm like. My nickname off some of my mates is Rock Pig. And I certainly have been a rock pig.
Rock pig.
So, but now I'm more like a big fat old sow lying down on his side while the rock pigs just suck every ounce of you out.
Jabba the Hutt.
Yeah.
And do you still play bass? I know.
George was really taken with that Feel It Still by Portugal the Man.
Yeah, tune, isn't it?
Which is a good tune. Yeah, so yeah. I'd sit there and play that for him, you know what I mean? Yeah. Or I'd sit there and play whatever's on the CBeebies channel theme music for him, you know what I mean?
Do you see bands like on TV, on live, do you hear bands on the radio now that you think, oh, I could be in that band?
Yeah, you never fall out of love with music. You know, when you're in a band, I think you'd always keep your eye open for what's coming next. You know, what could be the one that's going to... It's like a coconut shy. Who's going to lob the ball that knocks your coconut off your comfy little pedestal? I know for a fact when you were doing your radio stuff and you was watching bands like the Arctic Monkeys coming through and you know, I was thinking, yeah, man, because you're always all the time waiting for the next thing. Like, where's this generation's punk rock? Mm. So I think bands like that are kind of at the spearhead of that for the latest kids. And, you know, you look around you and there are good bands around. Mm. I think they went through a period of time where maybe early in the 2000s, and so music just seemed to take a dive, you know, yeah. And it was getting very careerist and nobody had anything to say. You know, I'm from the school of if you've got a platform, then bloody shout your gob off and make yourself heard and get your point out.
Make the world better.
Make the world better if you can, or try and turn people's heads onto something that they can then go make the world better with, you know what I mean? I'm still always waiting for the next punk rock movement. There's always something around the corner. Come on, get a move on.
Yeah, come on, you, the next generation. Yeah. Let's talk about this city then, Manchester. You were born and bred here. How much do you love it?
Well, do you know what? I tried living away from it for a year once when we'd been in Monmouth doing the second coming. And the countryside's lovely, but after a bit, when you're a city rat like I am, a city hobgoblin, as Marquee would have it, you miss the concrete and you miss the hustle and the bustle a little bit. And I will always have roots in Manchester, even though I can live anywhere. Manchester will always be my city.
Yeah.
I don't think there's another city like it on God's earth, to be fair. There's an attitude about the people here. We like to do things our way. We don't like to be told what to do. We're very innovative. You know, if you look from Rutherford and the guys splitting the atom, and you look at Alan Turing and you look at the people who've invented graphene, and you know, you look at the Pankhurst and the ladies' suffragette movement and the cooperative movement, and we do things differently up here. We're innovators. Manchester will always provide innovation, whether it be in the arts or what have you, science. I just think there's something in the psyche of folk from up here, you know. We won't have that London dictating to us. We'll do things on our own terms, and we're bloody right to think that way.
Absolutely.
We're a cut above.
I agree with that. Who would you say are your favourite humans of Manchester ever, Manny, past or present?
Well, I think, here's one for you, see if you remember this. The first band I can ever remember seeing live was when my dad worked at Oldham Rugby Club on a Sunday, and there was Sharples Hall Street Conservative Club. We were waiting there before a match at the Watersheddings, and I saw the Redcoats Experience.
Oh, yeah, brilliant.
And, wow. And he commented on my pants, which my mum had made. He said, oh, I like your pants. I don't know what his game was, but I was quite taken with the fact that some guy in a band had said my kecks were nice.
Amazing.
And
so Redcoats, is he one of your humans in Manchester? That's his first.
Can you believe that?
Put him in there.
Right, listen, you've also got to stick in there. Mancunian musical heroes for me are like Wayne Barrett and Mick Rossi from Slaughter.
Yeah.
Pete Shelley, God bless his cotton socks, and Steve Diggle from the Buzzcocks. You know, Barry Adamson is a bass player. Yes, he's right up there.
Yeah.
All the kids out of the Smiths, who I know very well and they're good friends. Mm. Anyone who's picked it up and run with it and made themselves a career gets a thumbs up from me in this city. You know what I mean?
Brilliant.
There's no such word as can't. There is can do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Finally, Manny, describe Manchester in three words.
Full of lunatics.
Perfect. Manny, the mod, Gary Mountfield, thank you for being a human of Excess Manchester.
Thank you so much, guys. Keep the faith.
That was Gary Mountfield, a.k.a. Manny. Next week, I'm joined by the iconic punk poet, Dr. John Cooper Clarke. Don't forget to follow us on social media and subscribe to Humans of Excess Manchester. Rate us, feel free to leave us a review. We love hearing what you think about our work. Thanks again to our friends at Safer Roads GM for sponsoring this series, and thank you for listening. See you next week.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.